Okay. I should stop dicking around with this. Got that fucking ding dang song in my head now. Having managed to get rid of it.
Sing sang song. Ding dang dong. UK hunt.
Very good.
Thanks.
Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonorable podcast, as truthful as resources permit. Jazza, if you were going to be a retired sleazy Tory minister, what sort of work do you think you'd go in for?
Ooh, great question. I would probably... I'd love to... Well, if you're going to go in hard, you know. So if I were to partake in that, like, it would have to be like oil baron, maybe something in kind of like... Something fossil fuel-y, I think. That would maybe undo all of the quote-unquote environmental good that I would have done while I was a politician. But maybe I'd work for somebody like Shell, who now, like, all of their branding and their... And their advertising is all about how green they are, despite the fact they're still basically drill baby drill. If you're gonna do it shamelessly, you know. It is 2021. Yeah, there's no shame anymore.
I do agree, but I would say that oil is a bit, you know, 20th century for me. I think something like sort of a data gathering operation in the style of Alexander Nix.
You know what I do? I do a cryptocurrency. So I'd maybe get on... I know that by its nature that the cryptocurrencies don't have boards, but I'd get on the board of Dogecoin and then lobby the shit out of that.
I mean, can you really lobby for easier regulations for cryptocurrencies when they're basically unregulated as it is? I'm trying to see the sort of regulatory arbitrage angle in this.
And, you asked me a comedy question. I gave you a comedy answer. Let's move. This wasn't based in reality, Jimmy. For goodness sake.
I'm trying to plan out my career here, Jazza, and you're just not providing me with useful inputs.
Mm-hmm. Well, in order for you to get into the sleaze, you have to be elected to Parliament first, and I don't think either of us really have a very high chance of that happening. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the. On that note, welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, where we meet every other week to talk about politics, social issues, and current events. I'm Jazza, and that was Jimmy. What are we going to talk about this week, Jimmy?
Well, as listeners might have gathered from the introductory question, we are going to be discussing Tory sleaze, or the return of Tory sleaze, as several newspapers and magazines have headlined various articles.
And Keith,
Flaccid Keith, the man himself.
Keir Starmer.
Also known as Keir Starmer to his wife and friends, presumably. So Keir Starmer, I think it was in PMQs or was it in another session, he sort of, you know, raised this concept of the return of Tory sleaze, which is a reference to the 90s John Major government, where basically every other junior government minister was being accused of having an affair with somebody or other, and you know, a lot of them were guilty of it, including John Major himself, although he managed to keep that one quiet.
With Edwina Curry or something, wasn't it?
Edwina Curry, the very same.
And good
people, when it... When it eventually emerged that John Major had been having an affair, his people were actually kind of impressed because he had such a boring reputation as the grey man of politics.
Literally, spitting image, they couldn't think of anything because he was anything to characterise him as because he was so boring. So they just painted him grey.
yeah, pretty much. And this time round, it's not actually so much affairs, although there is one that I think we will be talking about, but it's more financial corruption. So we spoke about the David Cameron lobbying scandal, I think 2 weeks ago now. And a couple more points have been added to that. I think for me, the most notable one is that Matt Hancock has acquired 15% of this company, Topwood, which has...
I own 15% approved. Of this company. Sorry, that was...
Yeah. So 15% of this company that is profiting from its commercial activities with NHS Wales, among other things. And he's also the health secretary. And the government says there is no conflict of interest.
It's just bad, isn't it? we'll talk about that. I promise there will be a little bit more than me just going, it's bad.
Not much more though. Let's be honest. This may be the yeah, go on.
Oh,
go on.
I was just going to segue into the next topic, which so the University of Hull or Hull University, who cares which order it goes around? But apparently, sometimes these institutions spend millions on the rebrand that just puts the place name in a different part of the sentence. But they have really interestingly decided to adopt more inclusive marking and evaluation practices in their in the marking of their courses, and obviously everybody's really happy about this and thinks it's a really great thing, because it creates a more inclusive space for those who maybe don't speak English as a first language, for maybe those who have learning difficulties or disabilities, and we're just going to be talking about how good that is, right, Jimmy?
Yeah, it's going to be a short topic, 2-3 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Good. I'm glad we agreed.
Good. Glad we agree. And finally, speaking of,
well, no, we should probably set the contention there is that everyone is now covering the story as Hull University no longer cares about spelling. So
which is a fair description of it, I would say. Kind of. It's not inaccurate.
Great.
And finally, as I was saying before, I'm so rudely interrupted, we are going to be talking about Prince Philip, who listeners may be aware has died at the age of 99.
Wait, what?
I think, yeah. I think it's quite, you'd be a little bit disappointed to have not made it to 100 if you'd
Was like, what, 2 months off of 100?
Yeah, you want to hit triple figures if you get that close.
And, like, you want your wife to send you one of them letters.
Well, yeah, I mean, he must have been, he sort of, throughout his life, seeing all these telegrams going out of Buckingham Palace.
Got
and
it.
Thinking, well, one of these days. Mm-hmm. But surprisingly, that hasn't been the angle of most of this coverage. What, there's simultaneously been a lot of coverage about him, his life, if you weren't already aware of it. His famous sayings as well. The Spectator.
His famous sayings?
Well, his gaffes, basically. Oh, you know, right. The offensive things he'd said.
Yeah, when he went to China and told the British students to not stay there too long because otherwise they'd get slitty eyes.
Yeah, that sort of thing.
Yeah, classic.
So, you know, following all of this coverage, there have been a record, I mean, it must be some sort of record, 109,000 complaints to the BBC over its coverage of the Duke of Edinburgh's death, seemingly because it went over MasterChef was one of the big contentions.
They also
Jazza?
No. They also simulcasted. They put the same program on, talking about Prince Philip on both BBC One and BBC Two. Radio One ended up doing only music tracks with no lyrics, and stuff like that. And everybody lost their shit. But I'm also like, iPlayer is a thing, as is Netflix.
Yeah, I think this controversy just passed me by because we don't we have a TV license, being, you know, law-abiding citizens in my household, but we don't have an aerial connection into the TV because it's 2021, guys. Mm-hmm. Like, it's use iPlayer. Mm-hmm. It's the internet, isn't it? It's the future.
Exactly. So there you go. We'll go into the music. Beg for some money because it is, it does help, it helps, you know. Thanks, everyone. Come back and do the actual episode. Okay, bye. Hello, dear listener. It is Jazza here. It is my turn to once again thank those who are already backing us on Patreon. We couldn't do it without you, so that we are able to cover stuff like hosting fees and stuff like that. Obviously, we don't really turn a profit on this podcast, but it really continues to make it viable so that we're not paying out of our pocket to keep this bad boy running. Thank you so much to Alexander, David, Andrew, Michael, John, Matt, and Gemma, for contributing to this podcast and making sure that we are continuing to be able to get it into your ears. If you are not yet supporting us on Patreon, we'd really appreciate it if you thought about it, maybe went over, had a look. We have regular bonus episodes. Actually, for each episode that we put out on this feed, we have a bonus episode, a bonus topic, where we talk about things. This week, Jimmy and I mainly just talked about going to the pub, to be completely honest, but it was incredibly cutting, crisp political analysis on the society that we do live in here in the United Kingdom. Okay, well, that's all. Thank you very much. If that hasn't convinced you, then I don't know what will. On with the rest of the show.
Jazza, out of all the Tories you've ever been aware of, who do you think is the sleaziest?
Good. I mean, it's Boris Johnson, isn't it? Like, that should be everybody's answer to that question.
He's pretty sleazy, surely, as it goes. Yeah, I mean,
but so does his shamelessness and the fact that it's all out in the open, does that reduce the amount of sleaziness? I feel like sleaziness, it's implied that it is under the radar to a certain extent. Do you know what I mean? Like it's something that's being hidden away. Whereas we know that Boris Johnson has about 7 children from different people.
I think it was 6 on last count, or at least 6. But yeah, no, he's had a long-standing reputation for underhandedness of various sorts. I think one of his first great public errors was when he was sacked from the Times, I want to say, for fabricating a quote.
Yeah,
somebody that he knew vaguely, because, you know,
he really is the epitome of failing upwards.
Oh yeah, massively. He was later sacked by, I want to say, sacked by David Cameron for lying about an affair he was having. That sounds like it could be right. So I think he even had
Can
a
you sack someone from that for having an affair?
No, he had an affair, and then he publicly said that the affair wasn't happening, and he was sacked for lying about it rather than the affair itself.
Right.
Basically. Right. I'm trying to remember this all offhand, but I think his most recent dalliance, I think, with sleaziness, if we want to call it that, was his affair with Jennifer Arcuri, which emerged
Why is that not... I mean, I know that we're in the middle of a global pandemic and we've just had the partner of the head of state die. And that is why it's not the top of the... And we have a former prime minister also embroiled in like another like lobbying scandal. I've just answered my own question. That's why it's not top of the thing. top of mind for everyone.
Yeah, so, I mean, the Arcuri story came out a little while ago, and it was sort of heavily, at the first instance, it was heavily implied they'd been having an affair, but I don't think it was quite confirmed by anyone.
She was, like, very coy about it, but it was very, to the point where it was so obvious that
they had been doing the day. And she received, it says, this is according to The Guardian, £126,000 in public money during the course of their affair, or at least roughly that time, including some money from London City Hall. It is kind of astonishing that, I mean, it's so corrupt. It's just so straightforwardly corrupt. And he's gotten away with it, basically. Mm-hmm. And as you say, he's simultaneously a very sleazy guy who's, been caught out lying numerous times in public office and misbehaving in various ways, who has had huge numbers of affairs. And I don't think you have to be particularly prudish about it just to think that there's something pretty... I mean, there's a lot of things that are pretty dodgy about the guy. And so maybe we shouldn't be surprised that the kind of culture of cronyism over the course of the pandemic and people's friends being handed contracts and that sort of thing has arisen.
I'm not surprised, but I still don't want it to happen. And those two things, and you can be critical, you can be not surprised and be like, well, of course this is happening, and still say that it is bad and want it to change.
Yeah.
Although I will say it was fascinating watching Rachel Reeves, who I think is usually a really good public spokesperson for the Labour Party. She was just talked into an absolute corner, or interviewed into a corner by Andrew Marr this morning, where he brought up the Kerwin Jones, the fact that he was First Minister and also working at Liberty Steel.
So is this the Welsh First Minister, Kerwin Jones?
Yes, correct.
Yeah.
And he, with a name like Kerwin Jones, for goodness sake, of course it's the Welsh First
Minister. Well, yeah. You've got to clarify these things, Jazza.
Sure, yeah. And she just didn't have a good answer for it, because these like there is a revolving door in the powerful institutions of this country. Like if you're an MP, whether you're an MP or a civil servant, going into the public sector, into the private sector, or vice versa, there of course is a revolving door. I think also there's like, I think that the, especially the David Cameron case and the Boris Johnson cases, and to be fair, quite a lot of the cases that we've heard about are really bad. But I also don't think that you should go into public service as like, and it is public service, being a member of parliament and being a civil servant are forms of public service, and then be expected to never work again. Like, I feel like you do have to.
Yeah, like, I mean, David Cameron actually
to have a job, but
David Cameron doesn't need to work again. Let's be
he doesn't need to, but if he wants to, Jim, he needs something to fulfill his life.
I mean, he's got his sheds,
doubling his wealth.
I just, I mean, I'm much more sympathetic in the
case, man shed,
in the case of like civil servants, particularly, you know, if you leave not too near the top, and you've still got like 20, 30 years of working life ahead of you, obviously those people still need to work. And I think it's reasonable that people are allowed to sell their expertise and their knowledge about things.
But to be clear, David Cameron was not selling his expertise and knowledge. He was selling his address book.
Yeah, so that is sort of the trouble with a lot of these things. And a lot of politicians or civil servants turn lobbyists is they're selling their contact book. So you were sort of mentioning how Rachel Reeves was cornered by Andrew Marr this morning. An argument that has been going around is that Labour can't really criticise Tory corruption because of people like Peter Mandelson, who runs a lobbying firm called Global Council, which in and of itself just sounds shady as fuck, right? Like it's if you were, it's almost as though he went to like one of those auto name generator websites, and just was like, what can my sleazy lobbying firm be called? So, you know, maybe that if you've been in politics, you're allowed to go and work for like a relevant industry, but you're not allowed to lobby, like, and not just in a kind of.
But then there would be ways that they'd be going, they'd be doing back channels. Right? Like if you used to work in parliament and then you go and work for somewhere else, but you're not allowed to lobby, you're still going, that lobbying is obviously still going to happen. In some way, shape, or form. Like,
yeah,
you can't
okay.
told never text Rishi Sunak again. If I had his number in my address book, I'd be texting him all the time.
Yeah, all right, Dishy, how's it going?
Oh, Rishi.
But the
Dishy,
funny thing is about
Dishy Rishi's dishes. That's what they should have called Eat Out to help out.
That's true, actually. Yeah, but we are getting sidetracked. The thing is that in all these kind of like statements, it's like, oh, you know, so-and-so didn't break the rules. But it's obvious what David Cameron was doing was wrong. Like, it's not complicated. And it's kind of you almost want to resort to like Ian Hislop was being interviewed by Private Eye and someone sort of asked him why he was reporting on all these like corruption stories through the years. And he was like, oh, well, you know, we sort of think that people shouldn't behave in that way. Just in kind of like a straightforward, do you know what I mean? Like pointing out corruption, you don't necessarily have to have this scheme for like rules and regulations, although you do need to.
Especially
if you're
a journalist and if you're Private Eye. I feel like Private Eye is not a think tank and isn't coming up with policy solutions, right? It is just shedding light on it, which is ironically something that David Cameron used to say about corruption, that shedding light on something like shedding light on things makes things. I need to look up quotes more.
Not one for the ages.
You get the vibe. You get the vibe.
Something about the best disinfectant or something like that.
Sure. Yeah.
But it's interesting how this scandal has ramped up. I mean, one of the things I was reading again in The Guardian is that there's a suspicion that some of the initial stories about Cameron's lobbying came from sources close to Downing Street or potentially in Downing Street, and that actually the...
What does that mean? Does that mean it's politicians or civil servants?
I mean, my best guess would probably be a special advisor, but it could be anyone, I think. it kind of just it basically means if source is close to, you know, Downing Street in this case, it's like somebody who knows, you know, the thing, you know, who knows the thinking, or, you know, it's an adjacent, I think you could say, but not necessarily somebody super important. Although I guess it could be, it is deliberately vague so that the person can't be identified. But you know, this story eventually has rebounded upon them. Like, it's ensnared Matt Hancock, we've already mentioned, Boris Johnson's conduct in relation to the Arcuri affair, Francis Maude, who's an old cabinet minister, can't remember what his previous role is, but he's conducting an unpaid review of civil service reform, and he's also running a foreign government advisory called Francis Maude Associates. And but the allegation's been made that he's sort of using his credibility as an advisor, and, you know, an unpaid advisor to Downing Street and the Prime Minister, as a way of, you know, burnishing his own business, basically, you know, sort of improving its standing. Which, you know, I suppose that you're kind of getting into slightly more tenuous claims about what should and shouldn't be allowed. I mean, I don't think you should be running. Necessarily be running like an advisory firm while still working in Downing Street, although I guess people would say, well, that will deter people from working in Downing Street for free then, which maybe is fine. I don't know.
I do think that's fine.
Yeah.
because otherwise there is the implied handoff of, oh, I'm doing this so that, because the payoff is I'll have the access to these people further down the line, right? And actually treating it like a normal job that has like a pay slip and whatever. That's important, because then there's, well, I mean, there's a paper trail. And that was kind of one of the things that came up with the David Cameron Greensill case, where, what's his name? Mr. Greensill.
Lex Greensill.
Lex. Oh, yeah, because he sounds like a
Marvel villain. Lex Greensill.
Yeah. Because he had... he was basically an unpaid member of Downing Street, wasn't he? He had a desk and everything.
He had a desk, yeah. It's, I mean, some of these, there's also this story about, what's this guy's name? I think it's Bill Crothers or something, who was simultaneously working as a Greensill director. So Greensill was a supply chain financing company until it collapsed. So he was working as a Greensill director for 2 months while he was also working as a civil servant. And there was a direct overlap in those two roles. That's obviously wrong. You know, I think it's something that is just flabbergasting about this story is, like, there's just a lot of behavior that's obviously wrong and that you shouldn't need, you know. I mean, I guess I shouldn't be, you know, you shouldn't be surprised when people behave when some people behave badly, but it's kind of, you're almost at a loss for words. Like, it's kind of like with the expenses scandal from years ago, where, like, that guy had used taxpayer money to, like, refurbish his moat or something like that. If you remember the story, it's like, obviously,
yeah,
that's,
oh,
not,
my God.
That's,
but
not what it's for, is it? Like, it's not fucking rocket science.
I think it's very easy for us to point and say wrong, because I feel like it's obvious that it's wrong. But I depressingly, and maybe this is because this is the old age catching up with me, I just, like, there is a line from Everybody's Free to Wear Sunscreen: politicians will philander. It is just a universal truth of human existence that the worst people are going to end up doing these jobs.
That's so depressing that you've just accepted that as a base fact, don't you think? I'm not saying you're wrong.
Regarde l'évidence. I don't know. I think that I am definitely much less right-haired, bushy-tailed when I worked in like a charity that was trying to get young people to register to vote. And now I'm definitely way more jaded than I was like 5 or 6 years ago. But I'm just like, what can we do about it? Other than revolution, like, what can we actually do? Like, get all of them out, completely reform the system, and start again from scratch.
Well, I think that's the only thing
we can do. This is what I'm calling for: it revolution.
One thing that can be done, I think, is to tighten up the lobbying rules. I mean, it's ridiculous that what Cameron did isn't captured by existing lobbying rules, and we already discussed that, but. Just obvious things like, don't own shares in a health company while being health secretary. you know, which should, I think, be obvious to anyone anyway, but clearly some people need it to be stated. And clearly there need to be significant punishments for if you break these rules. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's...
Ooh, what kind of a punishment would you like Cameron to have?
I mean...
Flogging? Name-calling?
Maybe the stocks, you know? I mean, why did we stop doing that? That seems like, you know... obviously, the rotten veg will be regulated. So, you know, we're not monsters here.
Yeah, so sure. We're not just going to let anybody bring anything. Anything.
Yeah, so... But... just something humiliating and unpleasant, I think. Maybe make the punishment.
Maybe making
the
them go on "I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here."
I don't know.
Something like a Bush Tucker trial, I think, would be inappropriate. Like getting David Cameron to... I reckon David Cameron, of all of the previous prime ministers, is the most likely of all of them to go on something like "I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here."
Or out of...
or Strictly Come Dancing.
Blair, Major, May, and... if I forgot...
Gordon Brown. Poor Gordon. No one remembers Gordon.
Sorry, Gordon. I mean, ironically, he's probably my favourite of them, I think, of the former
so
prime ministers.
But
I mean, in serious answer to your question, a hefty fucking fine, like a crippling fine.
Maybe that 60 million that he was meant to make off of the agreement that he had.
He would need another fucking job if that was the fine.
Yeah, good. stacking the shelves at Tesco.
I don't know. I wouldn't even...
Stack the shelves at Waitrose, wouldn't he? Let's be fair.
Yeah, I wouldn't even rule out a particularly, you know, for egregious offences, prison time. I think that's legit if you're that corrupt. Just, you know, punish them, man. Because, as you say, some people are going to break the rules. It's kind of inevitable. It is the sort of job that attracts greedy people with a lust for power and wealth and, you know, the normal things. So,
unless you're Caroline Lucas, you know. She wants none of the above.
Yeah, that is... in response to your general cynicism, I do think most politicians do go into, like... I think most MPs do go into it for the right reasons. I think they do want to make a difference and improve things, and I think there is a level of public spiritedness. Obviously, that is completely absent in somebody like Boris Johnson, but for a lot of people, I think... I think they mean well. I just think, you know, even people whose politics I don't like... Jazz is pulling a disgusted face here.
Now, I'm not... here's a tangential thank you, conversation. So I've re-downloaded Hinge today because I was like, you know what? I actually can go on dates to, like, beer gardens in the pub now. So I'll re-download Hinge, and I'm alone. So I was scrolling through. It took me 10 minutes... to find an account that said where the response to every question was, if you're a Tory, then don't like me. Like, what's the worst thing that somebody can do to you? Be a Tory. Like, it was that kind
of
vibe.
It took you 10 minutes to find that.
It was scarily quick to have somebody who had that, like, tone of a profile. And generally, I think that is a bad thing to have. However, I'm not saying all Tories go into politics for the wrong reasons, but all of the politicians that go into politics for the wrong reasons seem to be Tories. Like, at least UKIP had principles. Do you know what I mean? They may have been cuckoo doo lally and had a and like lied to get what they wanted, but they had a clear goal. Their goal was, I want to get the UK out of the European Union. Nigel Farage kind of, like, extra bits there. But they had, like, a principle that they lived by. I don't think most conservatives, and I hate saying this, I don't think most conservatives have the ideological backbone for anything other than just keeping power and having power.
Well, I mean...
But that is why they are the most successful political party in history ever anywhere.
I think you might have, you might have got our one Tory listener to turn off in disgust.
But there's plenty of principled Conservative MPs, but there are just so many that don't have any.
I suppose the thing is, like, if you want to become... I mean, this is like... I remember reading a George Osborne autobiography, autobiography, biography by an FT journalist. And it was basically saying that at a different point in time, George Osborne could have joined New Labour. Essentially, sure. The implication being that he just wanted to become a government minister. He wasn't that fussed about which party.
I mean, the same with Tony Blair, though. Right? Tony Blair was nearly a Tory.
I think Tony Blair could have fitted in the Tory party. His dad actually wanted to be a Tory politician and I think was a Tory activist.
Nick Clegg as well was nearly a Tory politician.
Well, I mean, some people would argue he actually was, given the coalition
shots fired. So, I can't believe you'd talk about Sir Nicholas in such a way.
Sir Nicholas. Now lobbying for Facebook, to various governments around the world,
right.
Which I think has brought us full circle. We probably could talk about this for a long time, but maybe we should move on to spelling, Jazza, and Hull University.
You suggested this, Jimmy. Go on.
I did. I might as well sneak in a little plug here. I did write about this topic on my Substack newsletter, jdenichols.substack.com, for anyone interested. I thought it's kind of interesting. So this story came out and I initially saw it in the Times and it was also reported in the Telegraph. And as Jazza kind of said, basically the Hull University and some other universities are no longer going to consider spelling, grammar and punctuation in their marking criteria for exams unless basically it's mandated by an external exam board or that sort of thing. So I'm actually a little bit skeptical about how many subjects this is really going to affect. I mean, it obviously won't affect exams like English literature, I wouldn't have thought, or probably even stuff like history or those kind of things. You know, exams.
Why do you think that?
Because I'd imagine a lot of those external boards do actually have, you know, spelling and grammar and punctuation in the marking criteria, certainly English literature.
So I don't know enough about this, but I don't think, but in university, in tertiary education, I don't know how much tertiary, like external exam boards are involved in the marking of, like exams and stuff like that. I have a feeling that that's all internal.
No, but they'll be setting the criteria for marking, won't they?
I don't think so. I think it's by university, yeah.
Oh. Well, okay,
which is why getting a first at Oxford is very different to getting a first at insert bad university here. I don't know.
But okay, I mean, let's put a pin in that because we don't seem to have, surprisingly for our listeners, we don't seem to have done the background reading. But the way this was pitched was deliberately, I think, by Hull University was, I think, deliberately kind of antagonistic. So it was described as essentially having, you know, proper spelling standards were described as homogenous, North European, white, male and elite modes of expression, which is, let's be honest, it's very culture warsy.
It is. I have been struggling to find where this quote comes from.
I think it probably is a legitimate quote. Do you think it's...
I would just love to see where it was. Like, I want to see what it was, where it contextually sat in a wider article. Because to be fair, like, all of those things are true.
I don't think spelling is particularly male, to be honest with you.
No, but it is the way... So, I tried to find some kind of, like, some sources from Hull talking about what is called inclusive practice in assessment, which is, I'm sure you know this, Jimmy, is what I was on the receiving end of as a dyslexic... when I was at university and school. So basically, it deprioritizes the way that you express yourself and prioritizes the thought behind what you're saying. Because my brain don't work good. And I think broadly, actually, like I say this a lot, I think that a lot of the practices that we use to help people with learning difficulties and learning disabilities actually should be employed for most individuals in the education system, because I read some things from the Teaching Academy at Hull where they were like, ways that we assess our students are rooted in like the 19th, sometimes 18th century. Like, I remember, like, I I did a master's at Oxford. And I had to dress up in like something called subfusc, which is basically like a Harry Potter robe. And I had to wear black tie and go into a specific building in order to do exams.
Is that true? That's incredible.
Which is completely normal at Oxford, but objectively nuts. Objectively fucking crazy, right? Like, I used to sit down in the exam hall and take all of the black... Because you had to go in and leave in full subfusc. I would go in, sit down, take everything off so that I was just in an undershirt and my trousers so that I could be comfortable. And then when I finished the exam, I'd put everything back on and then leave.
That is kind of ridiculous, yeah.
But that's like an extreme of...
It is
like
pretty extreme,
outdated practices that we have in tertiary education. But, from my perspective anyway, the thought that you have is, I think, should be more important than your ability to spell things properly.
I think that the spelling thing surely has to be a bit of a redundant point in the sense that, I mean, this is me being very ignorant about the way people take exams at uni, but surely a lot of it's done via computer these days, no? Do people have to still write out in longhand?
Depends uni to uni. I mean, we had to do everything in person. But Oxford is not...
It's quite old-fashioned. But in working life anyway, you will have access, like, when you graduate and go to an office job somewhere, which is where a lot of grads end up inevitably, you will be using a word processor. You won't be writing out things in longhand, will you? So the spelling thing is probably not that relevant most of the time. Like,
yeah, I'd probably agree with you.
I mean, even as somebody who... even as someone who, like... I think I spell reasonably well, which I suppose I should as an editor, but...
Literally your job, mate.
Literally my job. I still rely on, you know, spell checkers and stuff. Like, and, you know, if I'm typing something into Google, I won't spell it properly. I'll just, like, mash roughly the right keys and hope that the right thing comes out. Mm-hmm. I think the spelling thing... Grammar and punctuation, I think, is slightly more interesting in the sense that... You know, those things are things that computers are still not necessarily that great at picking up. They have got better sort of in the last 5 years.
Well, there's nuance in language with grammar and punctuation, right?
That yeah.
You can completely change the way that a sentence is read. But also one of the things that so obviously they wherever this quote came from, it skews culture warsy, right? Because of the fact that it says that it's steeped in kind of like this... I mean, it's old school stuff, but like an unrepresentative slither of humanity and the way that they assessed one another. And such a large proportion of the population going to university now from wider, well, you'd hope, wider backgrounds and from different educational backgrounds, so... from not necessarily as good schools, you don't necessarily have that base knowledge. Maybe you weren't taught like grammar and punctuation in the same way, and I don't think that that should be in as good of a way at your secondary school. And I don't think that should hold you back from A, going to university if you're really fucking bright, and B, being assessed for the thoughts and the academia that you produce. Because there are two things that you kind of, at the moment, in traditional ways that you get assessed in academia, that you get assessed on. One is the thought process and your methodology, hypothesis, and all of those kinds of things, which is kind of like devoid of how you write it down. It's like, oh, I've had this interesting take on X, Y, and Z. And then there is laying it out as like an essay. And that is a completely different skill.
Yeah, I mean, I will say that the essay writing thing, I think that the way that, at least from my perception, the way that people write, whenever I've had to work with somebody who's sort of recently out of university, essay writing is not really conducive to good writing in a general sense, I don't think, because the way that academia assesses writing is quite different. I would say academia in general encourages quite bad writing for various reasons we could go into, but I think this is actually a sort of broader thing to your point. the ability to convey your ideas in a compelling, clear and compelling way is very important. It's not like a minor part of being able to work, let's say, in a wider sense. I mean, there are some jobs where it's not relevant, like being able to write. There are some jobs that involve no writing whatsoever, and it's not really relevant. But I think a lot of the ways people work now, in terms of, you know, we've been working through lockdown now, so written communication has become much more important than it was when everyone was crammed into offices. Just in my own personal working life, I've had so many infuriating emails where people have essentially,
as per my previous email,
people have just totally disregarded any sort of sensible rules of communication. So I'm not that bothered about the grammar, punctuation and spelling thing, so long as it conforms well enough to, like, to be intelligible. But I am very interested in people being able to communicate clearly. And some of that does actually have to do, it does touch on things like spelling and grammar. The punctuation thing, I think, is kind of neither here nor there, because that usually doesn't really render the sentence unintelligible. But I think these things do matter. And I think that there are some people who struggle with them. And I think maybe you can sort of separate assessing somebody who's good at generating ideas and can think through processes and that sort of thing to someone who can convey things clearly. But the conveyance is important.
Those are two different things, right? Like, yeah. you can have fantastic original thought and, for example, be a great manager or leader or whatever, and be terrible at written communication.
Yeah.
And if that is your kind of like academic / intellectual makeup, then you're basically, it's difficult for you to thrive as in academia, as it's rooted in kind of like all of these traditions that are so focused on a specific type of skill in the written word, and a specific type of written word as well, that, as you said, doesn't necessarily translate to other forms of communication. So I'm okay with them using this inclusive practice. Even if it does piss off Hull Live.
That's a website where I sent you a story from about this topic. I guess I'd only say that I do think your ability to communicate matters, and if you are bad at it, that is a problem. I don't think it's like, I get your point about sort of, sometimes people can have their ideas dismissed because they're not able to communicate them clearly, but that's not a trivial point. If I was hiring for a job, for instance, and I had two candidates, and one of them was brilliant at the ideas, one of them was less good at the ideas, but like, sorry, one was brilliant at ideas, bad at communicating, the other was mediocre at ideas, but much better at communicating, I think there'd be a case for hiring the latter candidate, because if somebody...
Well, it depends on the job, though, doesn't it?
It does depend on the job. All I am saying is this is relevant. It's not something that should just be sort of waved away, like an inability to communicate clearly. It does actually matter.
I'm also not saying that those aren't important skills, but I think that they have been a barrier to accurate assessment to people's capabilities in the past. And I am okay with them trying to look at the root of somebody's thought process rather than the ability to write an essay.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that somebody's other skills shouldn't be dismissed just because they can't communicate very well. You should, should look at them holistically, Jazza, to use that word.
Love that. Let's stick a pin in that and circle back.
Just before we move on from this topic, Michelle Donnellan, the university's minister, has told MPs she was appalled at the decision by the University of Hull to scrap the need for students to meet literacy standards.
Who?
And that Michelle Donnellan, the university's minister.
Interesting.
And she said the government will act. This is from the Times as
Shut
well.
Up.
What does that mean?
I'm really over their private institutions. They can do what they want.
Oh.
Frankly, and I'm really sick of this government. Okay, where's my soapbox? I'm really sick of this government, like, just deciding that they're taking a culture war to university campuses. And, like, it's just boring. I'm so bored of it. Just try and end up having a proper dialogue rather than just throwing stuff at them and saying that they're all a load of fucking snowflakes. It's bloody annoying.
Well, this is kind of a, you know, a new part of a new chapter in the story of, as you say, the government's anti-university crusade, which previously has been around things like free speech and deplatforming people.
I'm over it.
You're over it.
Yeah.
Don't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about Prince Philip instead?
Why did I do this to us? Prince Philip died.
He did.
That's
die.
The tweet. Hey, you know what? So, in the grand scheme of things, I'm like, so if you are not from the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland,
or the Commonwealth,
then this probably all looks a little bit strange for you. To be completely honest, it looks a little bit strange to us, because I mean, there's not many people in the royal family. They don't die frequently. You know what I mean? The last time we had this kind of a big state funeral was the Queen Mother. In like 2001, 2000 and something, after Diana, and I remember Diana. I think Diana's funeral is probably the first time I ever remember, like, an actual event in the world.
Yeah.
Because I remember I was trying to watch cartoons on Channel 4, and my granddad didn't let me because he said that I should show some respect. So that's the kind of upbringing I had.
Clearly that message has permeated through your consciousness.
Well, to be fair, I am now at the point where it's like, and I tweeted this, because so many people were like, oh, he's a racist bigot. And he was. I mean, I think that there are enough... there are enough quotes and there's enough evidence to be able to assess that he was a man representative of a man his age when it came to views and thoughts around people who didn't look like him.
I think calling him a bigot is...
I think he was probably a bit of a bigot.
I think it's quite a nasty label to put on somebody, to call them a bigot.
All you have to do is change the tone of you saying it. Instead of saying that you're a bigot, say, he's a bigot.
I think he was a troll. I think he said a lot of things just to see what reaction would be generated.
But a lot of the stuff that he said was racist. Like, was rooted in racism.
Yeah, but some of it was very funny as well. So,
sure, you know, racism. Some people find racism funny.
I mean, his defenders would say that he said these offhand, you know, these off the wall, off color remarks to put people at ease. But it sounds as though you're not very amenable to that.
Well, no, like, watch anyone try and cancel Prince Philip, but I don't think it necessarily means that we have to cancel the. What am I trying to say? He's not going to change his the way that he was never going to change the way that he acted because people said that it was offensive. He didn't care. He was a 99-year-old man. Lots of old white posh 99-year-old men probably have similar views towards kind of like the way that we have reassessed history and probably thought that certain things are inappropriate. But a lot of people were being quite, like, cruel about him, about the way that he looked, especially, which made me quite uncomfortable, that it wasn't very social justice-y. Twitter, what are you doing? And so I tweeted when he died, you know what? At the end of the day, someone has died and people are allowed to be sad about that.
Wow, Jazza.
I'm so deep.
Bringing down the mood with your like normie logic, like joining the pylon.
Now, do I think? I mean, I don't. I'm not up for pylons anymore, to be completely honest.
You're too old.
I am too. I'm too old for that shit now. But I think it's appropriate that the consort to the head of state that there is a certain amount of pomp and ceremony about his death. Do I think that, like, 2 days' worth of back-to-back programming about how great he was is appropriate? I don't know. MasterChef sometimes does take precedent.
I think the sort of... So I actually saw a clip of when... I can't remember what TV show was on, but it was literally like, we've interrupted this program to bring you an important announcement, and then it was, you know, Prince Philip has died. Somebody made the point to me the other day, actually, that I thought was true, that during the, you know, during a national pandemic, maybe like suddenly interrupting a program and, you know, going, oh, something about, you know, we're about to make a big announcement, is maybe a little bit tone deaf in terms of, you know, causing people anxiety. And
so, you know what, the BBC app continues to try and send me stories that it thinks I'll be interested in, and it gets it wrong probably about 80% of the time. When all of that Meghan and Harry shit was going down, I was like, I muted the fucking app because I was like, I do not care. Whereas Prince Philip dying warrants, I think that does warrant a push
notification at least.
Yeah, at least a push notification. I would even go as far to say, sorry, we're interrupting this programming to bring you news that Prince Philip is dead. Like, I think that is appropriate. I will say, I think that so much of his death by media types was seen as a dress rehearsal for the Queen's death.
There is that, isn't there? But
I think it's important that we got a litmus test for how the public will react to that kind of things, and for them to have a nice little, well, it's not really a dry run, a nice wet run.
Wow.
I'm sure he'd have loved that.
Quite vivid invocation there. I guess the point I was trying to make is sort of in the age of, you know, iPlayer and internet broadcasting, this whole thing of like, oh, we're going to have like a media takeover for Prince Philip's death, mm-hmm. and, you know, we're just going to run back-to-back programming on the TV. It's a bit like, well, if you're interested in that sort of thing, couldn't you look elsewhere for it? But I suppose the argument goes both ways.
Anyone who was annoyed about this on Twitter knows what on demand is.
Yeah, that is true.
And you could have just done that. I mean, that was for the back-to-back programming is for a much older generation.
That is also true. Yeah.
They are more likely to think that it's a really big deal, and they're also more likely that that is going to be where they get their information from. I don't think it needs to be like 2 days, but I think maybe like 6 hours after the death, max, and then you can broadcast the funeral. It was quite nice, lovely sunny day. I thought that the custom Land Rover was very cool.
I haven't seen the custom Land Rover, I'm afraid. Like,
yeah, instead of a hearse, he had a custom Land Rover made.
Stylish.
It was very cool.
Bespoke.
But everybody was saying how he's going to be transported in a humble Land Rover, humble custom made Land Rover.
Oh my god!
And then not even all of the twittering and speculation around Harry and Will spoke at the funeral of their granddad. Shock, fucking horror!
I saw that news story on the BBC and I was like, I mean,
there's one thing that has come out of this. It's that royal correspondents are useless human beings and need to stop being paid to pretend to be be able to provide value at these kinds of things.
I think it's a much lower barrier for what constitutes a news story in royal correspondence than pretty much any endeavour of human life, I would say.
Harry and Will, literally a page on the BBC, Harry and Will spoke to each other before Harry left. Wow.
Yeah. That's just, it's kind of like, oh God, it's like a fucking reality TV show or something, isn't it?
It is, and I'd rather it weren't. It was nice to be reminded that, Eugenie is a princess. Forgot about her. Yeah, I haven't thought about her in a very long time. And what's the other one? Eugenie and
Beatrix, isn't it?
Beatrix, yeah. Odd names, says Jazza.
Yeah, that is some shade being thrown there from Jazza. There was someone made the argument just before we kind of round up this episode that the 100,000 complaints from the public was evidence of a sort of anti-monarchist sentiment among British people. And,
I don't think so. People were just annoyed, weren't they?
I don't think that's true at all. I thought this was Republicans grasping at straws. And I say that as somebody who wants the monarchy abolished. But it just...
Oh, shall we just reiterate like where we stand? So you like want full-blown republic, Speaker of the House is a symbolic head of state. Very boring.
I don't know. I don't have any particular designs on constitutional arrangements post-monarchy, but yeah, I want to get rid of them, basically.
Mm-hmm. Whereas I'm like, you know what? It's not broke yet. Dot, dot, dot.
It's not like, the thing is, it's not like top of my agenda. Like, if I ever, you know, in a bout,
if we could have the Queen forever, if we could have the Queen as a symbolic head of state after she died, maybe as like a Jesus figure. Yes. You know how there was that there's that Pacific Island nation who worship Prince Philip as a deity, and they kind of had a panic. And like, I let's just admit that we're all obsessed with Liz, and that she's the thing that's held this all together by not having any opinions in public. What's the best way of having someone continue to not have opinions in public? Have them dead.
She'll
continue to be head of state, and it's literally the crown is the head of state. So we just sit a crown on a throne, and we do all the blah 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 blah. We call it Elizabeth.
I think we could go one better, Jazza. I think we can cremate Liz, pop her in an urn, put like some sort of rubber stamp at the bottom of it, and then a civil servant comes along, picks it up, mm-hmm. and stamps it down to give the royal assent for parliamentary bills. And you know, can do other stuff as well. You can put the urn in the throne in the House of Lords for the.
You could maybe mechanize an arm or something that pulls away the cloth from a plaque, so she can still tour around there. We've solved everything.
I think
keep the monarchy, but make it a robot urn.
Oh, but who does the programming for the robot, Jazza? That's the focus will shift.
That'll be Prince Charles, won't it?
You think he's a keen programmer, do you?
No, but I think he thinks he is. You know, he gives those vibes of like being overly interested in things he doesn't really understand.
He very much does. Yeah, he does. But I suppose we can look forward to King Charles III quite soon, actually.
Why aren't they going to be quite soon? I think she's going to live well. I think she's going to live well into 100.
Well into 100.
I say well into. Well into is like 102.
I think living well past 100 is sort of a contradiction in terms, really. But
she's still got her corgis. But it is very sad. Like, they were together for a very long time, weren't they?
It is sad, isn't it?
Yeah, that is sad. She's lost her partner, and like she sat alone in the chapel.
I feel we're not taking this with adequate seriousness. So perhaps it's time to wrap things up.
Well, I'll take it seriously when she dies. I genuinely will. I'll be very, very sad when she dies.
Something to look forward to. If you want to contribute to that, the cultural debate with Jazza online, where can they find you?
On Twitter. I'm not really doing anything there at the moment. I was quite liberated. It was on and off. It was down for a while and then up and then down for quite a lot of this weekend. And it was very liberating.
You know, Jazza, you can bring Twitter down on a personal level just by closing your account.
I don't understand.
Delete your account, Jazza. Delete your account.
You even half of my followers.
All right, you can find me also on Twitter occasionally at JDE Nichols, and some other places like Substack.
He writes good stuff. Sure.
There you go. Have you got another YouTube gaming stream planned, Jazza?
Yeah, I do.
You'll have to
follow me on Twitter and Instagram to find out when that's out.
What a tease. All right, let's wrap up there.
Toodaloo.
Bye-bye.